Climate change is front and center for Latino voters when picking their presidential candidate. You told us about it.
Climate change is definitely on top of my list. I worry about the future of my three granddaughters. I have been experiencing the change in weather patterns in Florida with higher temperature, more violent storms, and floods.
I'm Arun Venugopal, and today on The Takeaway for February 20th, we'll break down how the Democratic candidates tackled the issue in last night's debate. Plus, magic. It's not just a man's game.
We don't have to do magic the same way. I think that women can be exploring different ways to do magic.
Also on the show... Indigenous peoples in Canada protest a natural gas pipeline, saying it infringes on their lands. We'll hear how these protests are putting a renewed scrutiny on Prime Minister Trudeau. We also hear the troubling story of a 17-year-old girl who spent 6 years of her life in U.S. immigration custody. She essentially disappeared in the system. All that coming your way, we start with the debate.
Democrats take a huge risk if we just substitute one arrogant billionaire for another.
I can't think of a ways that would make it easier for Donald Trump to get reelected than listening to this conversation.
You're literally in part of the committee that's overseeing these things.
Are you trying to say that I'm dumb, or are you mocking me here, Pete?
What a wonderful country we have. The best-known socialist in the country happens to be a millionaire with three houses. What'd I miss here?
A terrible idea. Let's get the facts straight. Let's get the order straight. And it's not whether he apologized or not. It's the policy.
It's not a plan. It's a PowerPoint. And Amy's plan is even less. It's like a post-it note. Insert plan here.
I wish everyone was as perfect as you, Pete, but let me tell you what it's like to be in the arena.
We are sick and tired of billionaires like Mr. Bloomberg seeing huge expansions of their wealth.
Mr. Mayor, are you willing to release all of those women from those non-disclosure agreements?
None of them accused me of doing anything other than maybe they didn't like the joke I told.
Yeah, it was gloves off at the Democratic debate in Nevada, one that featured first-timer Mike Bloomberg and a bevy of intense interpersonal moments between the candidates. But buried somewhere below the insults and hard truths was something we haven't seen too much of in the previous debates.
It is the existential threat that humanity faces, global warming.
If you're president, the first thing you do the first day is you rejoin the Paris Agreement.
I think we should stop all new drilling and mining on public lands and all offshore drilling.
There will be irreparable damage done, not just to Nevada, not just to Vermont or Massachusetts, but to the entire world.
Up until now, climate change hasn't gotten as much airtime as issues like health care or the economy. But thanks to Telemundo's Vanessa Hauck, the candidates were pressed on everything from fracking to holding oil and gas executives accountable for their role in harming our planet. Hauck was one of five moderators last night, but the first ever climate journalist to moderate a U.S. presidential debate. In a state like Nevada, climate change is top of mind. That's especially true for Latino voters, who are an increasingly powerful political force in the state, making up around 20% of the voting population. Studies have also shown that Latino voters are more engaged with the issue of climate change than other voting groups. For a look at how climate change is affecting Latino voters in Nevada and across the U.S., and how that might translate at the ballot box, we're joined by Edward Vargas, assistant professor in the School of Transborder Studies at Arizona State University and senior analyst at Latino Decisions. Hi, Edward.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And also Rudy Zamora, program director of CHISPA Nevada, an organizing program of the League of Conservation Voters. Hi, Rudy.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Edward, for a lot of people who are not Latino, there is a preconception, if you will, that they're all about one thing, which is immigration. How have we missed the importance of climate change given the size of the Latino population?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, for the longest time, Latinos have never been really thought of as environmentalists or conservationists, but that's contrary to the fact. In fact, Latinos care about the environment, care about climate change, actually in some of in a lot of polling data more than any other racial and ethnic group. And in fact, there's also a strong connection between climate change and immigration in terms of people maybe experiencing the impacts of climate change in their home countries and having to flee and or migrate because of climate change.
Okay, so it might be foundational for certain communities and keep them connected to the issue if, for instance, they're seeing water levels rise or deforestation and the like.
In addition to types of jobs, employment, particularly in the farm working communities or in other in logging or other industries, which are, you know, have the direct connection to the land.
But this is, of course, is not, Latinos are not a homogenous group in the U.S. They're not all the same. When it comes to climate change, is there a lot of diversity within this umbrella term that we use, Latinos?
Yes. I mean, whether it be first generation or moving up, you know, second, third, fourth generation and across economic spectrums, across national origin, we just see large variations and differences on Latinos being impacted on climate change. So, for example, we recently got out of the field on some data we were collecting with the Environmental Defense Fund Action Group. When we asked Latinos about climate change and if they've been impacted, and we see that, in fact, within the last year, we've seen a change from 27% to 46%. So almost, you know, a 19% change in people who say they've personally been impacted within the last year.
And Rudy, how do you see how did you see climate change play out last night at the debate? Were you happy at the extent to which this issue was addressed?
I mean, last night's debate was very interesting. I think it's the longest time that we've had the candidates talk about the environment. I think that was due to having Vanessa Hawk moderate the debate. We also saw that John Ralston, a local reporter here from Las Vegas, was the first one to ask that environmental question, allowing all candidates to answer. And it's really interesting to see that we're actually talking about the issue. In 2016, there's no time devoted to climate. And in this election, we've had very little time, but yesterday was the longest time that we've seen candidates talk about climate on the debate stage, which was really interesting for us. As we've seen, as we've mentioned, Latinos care about the environment. We see that Latinos in Nevada are interested in the environment. And as we mentioned, the environment is an intersectional issue that ties into immigration, ties into social economic justice, and ties into all the other issues that our families care about.
So, Rudy, do you think that the fact that we're in a state that has a significant Latino population, did that kind of force the issue in terms of the debate last night?
Well, I think that was part of it. But we also see that last night's debate is leading up to the Nevada caucus on Saturday. And we're the first state that's actually a representation of the country, with Latinos in the state making up 29% of the population. We are seeing a huge majority, the candidates talking about how they're going to reach out to Latinos. And climate is that conversation that we want to talk. We see that the issues is what's going to get voters to align, not the bantering that we saw at the beginning of the debate last night, but actually talking about the issues and talking to community about what they're going to do, what their plan is that day when they walk into that Oval Office. What is their plan to enact?
Yeah, and it can be hard to pay attention to some of the issues given how much the horse race seems to prevail at so many of these events, certainly if you look at social media. But I'm curious, were you struck by anything the candidates actually said when it comes to climate change?
So, you know, they all addressed very different parts of climate. As a Nevada voter, I think they're just hitting the ice on the top. They need to dig deeper. They need to continue having conversations. We see that in Nevada, we have Reno and Las Vegas, who are the hottest cities in the country, and our temperatures keep rising. As we mentioned earlier, that impacts our social economic justice. So we're scratching the very, very tip of the conversation around climate with candidates. I think it's important for them to continue to talk about the issues and tell us what those plans are, not just say we have a plan on paper, but actually tell us how they're going to put that in place. What's number one thing they're going to do on day one?
You've recently polled Latino voters about climate change through your work with the League of Conservation Voters. What do the numbers tell us about Latino voters?
The numbers show that, again, that climate is a number one priority for us here in the state of Nevada. We've seen the numbers keep reflecting and the environment is the number one issue. But I think it's interesting with the poll, as it was mentioned earlier, we as Latinos have often been just pushed to one issue, and that issue typically is immigration. But as we were talking to voters about the environment, we see that people have been doing this for years. I think it's one of those things where the Latino community is now a permanent seat at the table around the environment. Our families have been taking care of the environment since day one. You want to talk about recycling, you want to talk about conserving energy. You can go into any Latino household and you will probably hear the mother say, close the door because you're letting out the cool air. Make sure you turn off the lights if you're not in the room. So we've been doing it for different reasons. And it's not until lately that we were able to get a seat at the table where policymakers are listening to us on why climate is important to us.
And Edward, a study from Yale showed that while Latinos are more engaged with the issue of climate change than non-Latinos, it's even more intensely felt among Spanish-speaking populations than English-speaking Latino populations. How do you understand this distinction?
Yeah, you know, we see that. We also see nativity differences. In other words, being foreign-born relative to being born in the United States, we also find differences. But I want to go back to this, something that Rudy said that I think is important for the Nevada is that, in fact, something about 85% of Nevada is managed by federal government in public lands. And, you know, last night they brought up the issue of drilling in public lands. And our data shows that only about 7% of Latinos think that we should be expanding in fracking. So very, very few Latinos believe that that's really the way to go. We much more support for the reduction of carbon pollution. So, I mean, I think that what Rudy talked about kind of, I think it's important to contextualize Nevada as a really important state, particularly in public lands. And as Rudy had mentioned around heat waves and the number of days above 105 degrees. But in general, foreign-born, and a part of this has to do with ancestral homeland and ties to the homeland and places in the South experiencing climate change much more frequent, whether it be earthquakes, whether it be droughts, a lack of drinkable, potable water. This is happening in their countries of origin, and they're seeing it first. So that's why we would expect Spanish speakers to poll higher.
I see this figure from the publication Grist saying that 18% of the Latinos in California live in one of the top 10% most pollution-burdened communities compared to less than 3% of white state residents. Is that figure something you can kind of extrapolate across the board, across America? Is that something that Latinos have to deal with in general?
Yeah, all populations who are under-resourced, who are living in sort of poor economic communities, are living around dumps, are feeling the effect of smog and air pollution, living around zones that have been contaminated, whether it be old military bases. And so that's across the board.
Thank you, Edward Vargas, Arizona State University and senior analyst at Latino Decisions, and Rudy Zamora, program director of CHISPA Nevada. Thank you both for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on today's show.
Muchísimas gracias.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Arun Vanagopal. When you think of the world's great magicians, you think of Houdini, Copperfield, Penn and Teller.
Come on!
Maybe others, but not necessarily Adelaide Herman, one of the world's first successful female magicians known as the Queen of Magic. For almost two centuries, sexism excluded women from magic clubs and kept female magicians from achieving the type of fame their male counterparts enjoyed, leaving many potential female magicians without role models and roadmaps into the industry.
I was always interested in magic as a child, but there was nowhere for me to learn how to do magic as a girl.
That's Margaret Steele, a magician and magic historian, but she says the barriers to women in magic are starting to change. In the last few years, the International Magician Society and the Academy of Magical Arts have reported significant increases in the number of female members and women taking classes at their magic schools. Yet, even with these strides, there's still a long way to go for women in magic. The Society of American Magicians, the oldest magic organization in the world, only has 300 active female members out of 4,000. That's around 7.5%. I asked Margaret Steele to take us back to the origins of this gender disparity.
Holders of the secrets in magic have always been men. The gatekeepers have always been men. The secret is the magician's livelihood. So they have a vested interest throughout time of not sharing the secrets. So they wanted to keep everybody out, and that certainly included women. But magic began about 200 years ago, and at that time in Europe and everywhere, there were very clearly defined gender roles, and these gender roles were very polarized, and they were mandatory. So men had all the power, and men were the magicians, and women were always the assistants.
Often there just for sort of cuteness or sex appeal.
Well, that's what they want you to think. But actually, this is why the culture of magic and gender inequality is kind of hard-baked into the actual art, because that's what you're supposed to think. You're supposed to think that the magician's assistant is a vapid, just pretty little thing. But because of that, she is flying under the radar, and you don't suspect her. So she can get away with anything.
Oh, so she's part of the ruse.
Absolutely, she's part of the ruse.
Mm.
So she's flying under the radar, and she is the secret, special, hidden assistant because of that. You're not suspecting her.
So right now we're seeing that at the national and international level, all these magic organizations are reporting pretty significant growth in the number of women who are interested in performing magic. Is this something you're observing firsthand?
Absolutely. I'm seeing that the culture is finally presenting women magicians. But we need to distinguish between the culture of magic and the craft of magic, because those are two different things. The culture of magic is the magic societies, the magic clubs. And the magicians you're seeing now are coming out of that culture. The magic clubs that present to the public are still draw from that culture. The magic television shows draw from that culture. But the magic craft is different. The skills can be used in lots of different ways. So there are actually a lot of magicians out there, women doing magic, that are not part of that culture at all, that are making very good livings. For example, there's one branch of magic, very large branch of magic, that it's actually even an advantage to be a woman, and that would be magic for children and families.
Hmm. But how do you, if you're trying to kind of break this sort of closed society of professional magicians, people who have something to share, but essentially have control over this body of knowledge, how does one as a young woman go about doing that?
The good news is they don't have control over the body of knowledge anymore.
Mm.
There are other ways to find it. You absolutely need a teacher to do magic, but it's all in books and it's all in videos now. So you can learn how to get started. And one of the paradoxes of magic is that it's actually very egalitarian. If you can find a way to learn the skills and put the work in, magic on a high level takes years of work and practice. But if you put the work in and speak the language of magic, you're invited in. You're able to be part of that culture. But the problem is it's a very insular, ingrained culture that has not had much feminine influence for a very long time. So the culture itself is what needs to be modernized.
And so what kind of backlash do you see from the male gatekeepers in this world?
I got a lot of backlash when I was starting because early on there was a lot of hostility to women in magic. And there were actually magicians who were hostile to me, and they would say, girls can't do magic. It wasn't women, it was girls.
They would actually say that.
Oh, sure. Girls can't do magic. Girls shouldn't do magic. But most of them have passed on. And magicians want women, they just don't understand why the culture isn't comfortable for women. And it's very entrenched, and it's definitely a boys' club. And my point is that we don't have to do magic the same way. The archetype of the magician is a very strong male archetype. It's the first tarot card, the magician with the powerful magician with the wand, almost a superhero. And my point is that we can be equal, but we don't have to be the same. So I think that women can be exploring different ways to do magic. The second tarot card, which is the one that counterbalances the magician, is the High Priestess. Hmm. And that's a character and an archetype that can be explored more deeply.
When we think about the 20th century, the turn of the 20th century, it was more common to see women as mentalists or psychics rather than magicians. Is there a reason for that, why we saw women perform these types of illusions rather than the ones we typically associate with stage magic?
Well, yes, because you had to have the access to the secrets, but also at that time, that was the time of the spiritualist movement.
Mm.
And many of the spiritualists were women, and they were using the same tricks, but they weren't using them as magic tricks. They were using them as a vehicle to actually convince people that they were communicating with their dead relatives. And magicians didn't like this very much, but that was a niche that women could exploit. The archetype of the magician is a man displaying his powers, holding a wand, and society has always been much more comfortable with a man displaying his powers than with a woman displaying her powers. Even now, society treats women and men displaying power differently. So imagine what it was like 100, 150 years ago. So a psychic has the powers expressed through them. They're not the originator of the power.
So we're seeing all these young women entering magic. It's becoming more visible. We're still not seeing these female magicians getting TV specials like David Blaine or headlining Las Vegas like David Copperfield. Is that something we can expect? I would think that Netflix or the like would really tap into something, and there'd be a lot of viewers for this. But are these kinds of talents on the horizon?
They're on the horizon, and they're also in the past. There have been women that have headlined Las Vegas shows. There have been women that have had TV specials. Not lately, but there have been, and there definitely will be again, because there are some incredible talents out there now.
Who should we keep an eye out for?
Carissa Hendricks, for sure. She's an up-and-coming magician, but there are also magicians you're not seeing that are doing incredible work, too. She's an established woman, one of the great magicians of the 20th century, male or female, who's not in the magic community anymore. Her name is Lisa Mena, and she is working with an organization called Cause to Wonder that travels to indigenous and poor communities all over the world using magic to help the lives of women and people.
Wow.
There's a lot that's going on beyond the magic culture. So we see magic as entertainment, and it's wonderful. Magic as entertainment is a wonderful thing, but the craft of magic and the tools of magic are very powerful and can be used in many different ways.
Margaret Steele is a magician, magic historian, and the editor of Adelaide Herman, Queen of Magic, Memoirs, Published Writings, and Collected Ephemera. Margaret, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
And Margaret was gracious enough to perform some magic for us here in the studio. You can see one of her illusions by heading to our Instagram page or finding us on Twitter or Facebook.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
On this week's On the Media, what happened to the offbeat, irreverent, speaking truth to power alt weeklies that used to populate newsstands across the country?
The Voice was your guide to life from people who cared about what they were covering with such intensity that there were fistfights and brawls inside the paper. That's gone.
The end of an era on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Arun Venugopal. Welcome back to The Takeaway. Latin America has a long history of making people disappear. During the Dirty Wars in the 1970s and 80s, governments in the region would routinely disappear people who were never heard from again. But today we have the story of a different kind of state-sanctioned disappearance, one that's taken place here in the U.S. In 2013, a 10-year-old Honduran girl and her 8-year-old brother requested asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border with their aunt. They were placed in the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, the federal agency that's in charge of detaining and then reuniting unaccompanied minors. But after the siblings were placed into the system, their family never heard from them again. The children were separated. Today, the girl is 17 years old and has spent 6 years of her life in federal immigration custody. It's been years since she was in any contact with her family. Aura Bogado, reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, found the girl and her family, and she joins us today to help walk us through this powerful and deeply unsettling story and what it tells us about our immigration system. Aura, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Arun. Thanks for having me on.
How did you find out about this girl's story?
Well, I heard about it, and I was intrigued. I wanted to make sure that it was true because what I heard about her length in stay for 6 years was far longer than any other child I had ever heard about. And I became pretty focused on trying to find her family and figuring out if everything matched up.
But you had to, I guess, turn over quite a few stones before you had any sort of connection to her, correct?
Sure. Migrants, a lot of times there aren't a lot of public records for people. And I used social media a lot. I contacted many people that I could think of in three countries. And eventually I did find a distant relative who connected me to the family right here in North Carolina.
And so she had a sponsor, her aunt. Why was she never placed in her custody?
That's a great question. And it's a question I've been trying to figure out for the last 3 months or so. The family says that they were never given notice about a possible rejection for the sponsorship. They were in touch. They were doing everything that they could on their end, fingerprints and handing over all kinds of information to the government just to get her back. And then contact was completely cut off. They don't know why. And I haven't been able to figure out why either.
And what are we hearing from the Office of Refugee Resettlement? Have they responded to your requests?
They've responded to some requests more than others. What I would really like to know is how many situations there are like this, and we don't know. The Office of Refugee Resettlement hasn't told us, and so Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting is now suing for those records to find out how many kids are there that have been disappeared from their families.
So it could be a handful, it could be dozens, it could be hundreds, potentially.
We really don't know. That agency is the one that has the answers and hasn't answered.
Aura, doesn't the Office of Refugee Resettlement have rules or laws that would prevent a child from being in custody for this long?
You would think so, and that's what I thought. I'm an immigration reporter, and I focus on unaccompanied minors or children who've been rendered unaccompanied by the government after being separated from their families at the border. But there isn't any hard rule that I can find that really limits the amount of time that a child can be in custody. And I know that you were talking with a previous guest about the debate last night. And I think that one question that any candidate should be asked is whether or how their administration plans to do better. Will it, like the Obama and Trump administration have done in this case, hold children away from their families indefinitely? Or would a new administration implement some fundamental changes that would prevent this from ever happening again?
An important point that you bring up, the fact that this started under the Obama administration, and I guess she was under their custody for several years during that administration.
Correct. So half of the time she was under the Obama administration and half the time she's been under the Trump administration.
Do we know what the effects are of 6 years in government custody for a child?
So I spoke with a specialist on this, Dr. Daisy Camacho Thompson, and when we were talking, she asked me to think back about when you were ages 10 to 17 and everything that was going on, everything that was developing for you emotionally and cognitively. And she was explaining to me that periods of transition for adolescents, even going to a new school, is tough. You're just trying to figure out how to be a human in society. And something that sort of helps buffer those transitions and those moments of stress are having your family with you, your family who knows your culture, knows what you like, knows what you don't like. And, those kind of family relationships are not always the easiest, right? Like, we know that teenagers may have a lot of problems with parents, but there is such an advantage to being able to be with your family during these times. And we know that she's been placed in at least 7 different places over the last 6 years, places with long histories of abuse, one place that's known for forcibly drugging children. She's just been in and out. And during that time, she hasn't learned how to read and she hasn't learned English. And so, Dr. Camacho Thompson explained to me that there are just long-lasting emotional and cognitive effects as a result of these kinds of separations.
You actually encountered this young woman, correct?
I did. I heard about her immigration court case last month, and I flew up. I heard about it on a Wednesday, and I was there Wednesday night, and I saw her in court.
And what was that like?
Well, I had heard so much about this girl from her family, and I recognized her right away. I knew exactly who she was when she walked into the lobby. And I saw, a very prim and proper immigration court, it's kind of like wood lined and everyone is very reverent. It's very nice for a place that can wind up upending people's lives. And she was there to ask for voluntary departure. And she was granted that by the judge. At the time, it made sense to me. This girl's bounced in and out of so many places. I came to learn later that she thought her family had abandoned her. So why not? Why not take the little agency that you do have, which is your ability to get out of that shelter system and go back to a country that you have some memory of from when you were a lot younger, and be out? It made sense to me at the time.
So what's going to happen to this girl moving forward? She actually requested to be deported just before you helped her get in touch with her family. So can the family fight for her to stay?
So in the immigration court that day, she was asking for voluntary departure, which makes sense because she has been shelter to shelter. I found out that since then she thought that her family abandoned her, and the judge granted it. He granted her request to leave the country, and he also ordered that she now must leave the country by the 15th of May. It's important to note that while I was able as a reporter to figure out when her immigration court date was, the family wasn't even made aware. They didn't even know that she had a court date, much less that she was going to ask to leave the country, the same country that they fled because of violence, very brutal violence, which they had experienced in Honduras. So now the family is trying to figure out, can she stay? Can she not stay? She's still not with the family. She's been in touch with them, and she has communicated over and over again, not only to her family here, but also to family in Honduras, which she very, very recently connected with again, ever since I started reporting on this story. And it's unclear whether she will be able to ask the judge to reopen or reconsider her case. And so every single day when I wake up, I try to figure out, is the girl still in the country, or has she been deported back to the place where she fled so many years ago?
A very troubling story from Aura Bogado, who is a reporter at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Aura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Arun.
For 2 weeks now, activists across Canada have blockaded rail lines and ports to protest the construction of a natural gas pipeline on Wet'suwet'en First Nation territory in British Columbia. Whoa. While indigenous leaders along other parts of the pipeline route have signed off on the project, Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs are standing firm against the construction on their land. And nationwide demonstrations escalated after Canada's federal police forces began arresting Indigenous protesters earlier this month. The protests have led to intense scrutiny of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who's made a point of emphasizing dialogue with Canada's Indigenous communities during his time in office. On Tuesday, the Prime Minister addressed Canada's House of Commons.
There is no relationship more important to Canada than the one with Indigenous peoples. And today, as Prime Minister, I am once again formally extending my hand in partnership and trust. Over the last 11 days, our government has been working on a path forward, even as many have been saying we should give up. Because we know what is at stake. We know that we cannot afford to fail.
Joining me now is Dr. Veldon Coburn, assistant professor at the University of Ottawa's Institute of Indigenous Research and Studies. Veldon, thanks for coming back on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me, Arun.
Help us understand, what is the significance of this pipeline, both to its proponents and to the people who oppose it?
Well, for the proponents, I think they've sold it because its liquefied natural gas is having lower CO2 emissions, a little bit better for the environment overall. Canada's a massive producer of CO2 through our Alberta tar sands. And for some of the other proponents, and for those that are supporting it, especially some First Nations, is that it's an economic opportunity, because in Canada, a lot of the rural and remote First Nations that, due to the history of colonialism, have been shuffled off to very distant parcels of land and denied a lot of economic development opportunities that this offers their peoples, I guess, financial and monetary and other material benefits. For the opponents are, I think, two threads that come out of it. Some places they overlap, but in other places they do diverge. One is the issue of, I guess, the climate change folks, people who are more attuned to, I guess, any kind of change or anything that might damage the environment. But the other issue that I think is at the forefront of my own mind is the issue of Indigenous sovereignty in Canada. So having corporations backed by the Canadian state, driven through unceded Indigenous territory, lands that have never been surrendered or yielded to the Canadian state, where titles still vest with the First Nations. So it is an issue of territorial integrity and sovereignty for these Indigenous nations.
Okay, so this gets us into some very complicated and fraught Canadian and colonial history. In most of British Columbia, there are no formal treaties between tribal nations and the Canadian government. So how has that complicated negotiations over the construction of this pipeline?
That's right. So one of the provinces, and it's one of the last provinces to come into Confederation in Canada, never thought it necessary. And it was also a point in Canadian Confederation history where they never viewed, or they stopped viewing, treaties as between nation and nation. And it was just basically a one-way sort of piece of dominance of the colonial crown. So they never really got around to it, quite like the other provinces, and Quebec's being an exception because they never really entered into treaties as well. But what is recognized in Canadian constitutional law is that title, the land, and all the legal interests still vest with Indigenous nations in British Columbia, with the exception of a few areas. So putting through large pieces of infrastructure like pipelines, and even if it's other like transportation infrastructure like highways or what have you, they have to deal with the fact that this land still belongs to the Indigenous nations.
And give us a sense of how active are these demonstrations? How intensely are they opposing this?
I think across Canada, because a lot of the movements are, or at least the blockades that have popped up all across Canada, and our countries are almost as wide apart as one another. So from West Coast to East Coast in Canada, dotted across the country are a number of blockades in different provinces, different cities. I think it's mostly in solidarity, again, with the two prominent themes of this sort of resistance and opposition, both the environmental issue and also the First Nation sovereignty issue. So in the last couple of years, probably in the last 6 or 7, this is probably the most prominent sort of Indigenous resistance movement that we've seen since what was known as Idle No More, which was a very consolidated, congealed movement back in 2013, 2014. And that was probably the largest since the 1960s.
And do you see this this movement drawing in a lot of people who are not Indigenous as well?
Yeah, I think there's a great deal of non-Indigenous solidarity. Some tagging along, hoping that this is an environmental issue, but a lot seem to be quite aligned with Indigenous sovereignty and legal issues and constitutional issues too. So resistant to corporate intrusion and corporate sort of backing by the Canadian state.
We're hearing more and more about issues like pipelines and sensitivity of Indigenous communities to these kinds of projects. Do you see us headed to some sort of reckoning in terms of the place of Indigenous communities in the larger political landscape?
Certainly. I think in the last 5 to 10 years in Canada and talking with American counterparts who are Indigenous and teaching in American institutions as well, is that the entire issue of Indigenous settler and in our shared colonial history is really emerging into the public consciousness of both countries. So living coexistence and understanding how we constitute ourselves as people who neither of us are really going away. Nobody's going back to Europe, to our roots, is probably understanding that how do we justly acquire territory and govern over it? How do we understand jurisdictions where title still vests with the original peoples? So this is an issue, especially with large infrastructure projects that aren't going away, and with a growing Indigenous population, the youngest and fastest growing, it is something that definitely both your country and my own will have to reckon with.
Dr. Veldon Coburn is an assistant professor at the University of Ottawa's Institute of Indigenous Research and Studies. Veldon, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.